This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is Intelligence Matters with former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morell. Brought to you by Palantir Technologies, foundational software of tomorrow, delivered today.
Zalmay Khalilzad is the former United States ambassador to the United Nations, to Iraq, and to Afghanistan. He played a major role in the formulation and execution of Afghan policy over the past 20 years. We just sat down with the ambassador to talk about what went wrong in Afghanistan. We'll be right back with that discussion after a word from our sponsor. I'm Michael Morell, and this is Intelligence Matters.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Ambassador, welcome to our show. It's great to chat with you again. It's been a while.
Well, it's great to be with you. I'm looking forward to the chat.
Before we get to that, I did want to mention that you're the author of a terrific book called The Envoy, From Kabul to the White House, My Journey Through a Turbulent World. You're going to have to update it or even write a new book, given what's happened the last couple of years.
Yes, I'm very much thinking about that. Thank you for what you said about my previous book.
So, Ambassador, I want to kind of cover the waterfront here, and I want to start by going all the way back to the U.S. involvement, or rather lack of U.S. involvement in Afghanistan in the aftermath of the withdrawal of Soviet forces in 1989. And I'm wondering if you think there are things the U.S. could have done in that period or not that would have or could have precluded the Taliban's takeover of the country just a few years later and would have prevented pretty much all of the mess that we've had to deal with?
Well, that's a very important question, a question that I have pondered on. It goes back to the struggle against the Soviet Union in the 1980s, as you know well. We assisted the Afghans, the United States, and in their struggle and their resistance against the Soviet Union, which had come into Afghanistan after a pro-Soviet coup had taken place and it had run into difficulties because it was seeking to transform Afghanistan to a Soviet republic in terms of internal reforms. And traditional Afghan leaders, tribes, and religious leaders resisted that effort, and a significant conflict took place. Among the forces that fought the Soviets the hardest were Islamic forces, led by some of the people who are still around, like Gulbuddin Hekmatyar of the Islamic Party. And we, working together with our partners and with Pakistan, supported those forces. But our assumption at that time was, as we were supporting those groups, that the Soviets would ultimately prevail. And therefore, our objective became to impose as much cost as possible on the Soviets to deter further Soviet expansion. There was some belief that the invasion of Afghanistan may have been part of a broader effort to get to the warm waters, a long-term Russian objective, it was assumed, and towards the Arabian Sea and the Persian Gulf. They had come closer by invading Afghanistan. But as it turned out, we were more effective than we thought, the Afghans and us, in imposing costs. And the Soviets were not as tough, as determined as we had assumed, and the Soviets ultimately agreed to withdraw from Afghanistan. And if at that time, as the Soviets indicated they were going to withdraw, we could have worked together, perhaps with the Soviets, and with more moderate Afghans to put a government together that would have avoided a continuing war that ultimately led to the civil war and the Taliban takeover. Perhaps the current and subsequent steps could have been avoided. But we didn't, in part because we didn't trust the Soviets. We didn't even believe that they were serious about withdrawal. There was also the idea that how could one adjust against forces that had given us this great victory, which it was, the victory against the Soviets in Afghanistan. It may have helped to the collapse of the Soviet. To what extent, we don't know. Initially, we continued our support of the anti-Soviet Mujahideen, as they were called. But ultimately, we sort of abandoned Afghanistan, and as I said before, a civil war happened, and that Al Qaeda was part of the mix in that civil war.
Yeah, missed opportunity.
A missed opportunity, potentially. Scholars would have to look at that in greater depth than I have just described.
So let me then jump, Mr. Ambassador, all the way to the immediate aftermath of 9/11. As you know, President Bush gave the Taliban an opportunity to avoid war, you know, essentially bring bin Laden to justice in some way. The Taliban chose not to do that. But once they were driven from power, once the Taliban was driven from power, I'm wondering whether you believe there might have been missed opportunities in the early years after 9/11 regarding how we and the new Afghan government dealt with the Taliban that could have ended the war much earlier and more on our terms than where we ended up. Were there missed opportunities there too?
I believe so. Although at that time, I was personally not aware of it. But I have learned since that after the agreement in Bonn, when the Taliban government was overthrown to form a new government that the UN had the lead on, the Taliban apparently, this had been confirmed to me by President Karzai, that they did give a letter essentially accepting the Karzai-led government as a legitimate government, but demanding in exchange for that, and that they be allowed to live in dignity and honor in their homes and not to be pursued. President Karzai asked them, he said, this is Karzai's report, to go and read that letter on the radio, in a local radio in Kandahar, and he says they did. But why that agreement was not accepted, why that offer was not acted on the one hand, It's understandable that there was a great deal of anger in the U.S. given what had happened. President Bush several times told me directly, as his envoy, and then when he nominated me to be his ambassador to Kabul, that we should bring the Taliban to justice. And whether there could have been a different balance between the requirements of justice and the requirements of reconciliation and ending the war in Afghanistan, I think there was a missed opportunity then. And Karzai reports that he was told by one of our senior leaders that was not an opportunity or an option that we could support that Taliban offer, and that we wanted, still there was a lot of accountability that had to take place. So that was, in my judgment, a missed opportunity.
So during this period, just after 9/11, you were on President Bush's National Security Council staff. You and I used to see each other in the mornings often. I'm wondering if you can explain to folks how we went from a narrow CT mission in Afghanistan just after 9/11 to a broader nation-building mission. How did that happen?
There were two factors that I think led to it. One kind of directly and one sort of almost without a direct confrontation and debate of the issue. And the one that was more direct was the issue that in order to preclude Afghanistan ever again becoming a platform for terrorists such as Al-Qaeda, who was going to ensure that? Were we going to be occupying Afghanistan and ensuring that preclusion? Or were we going to build the Afghan security forces and institutions of Afghanistan so that the Afghans would do it? And I think over time, incrementally, with a variety of steps, such as starting the building up of Afghan national security forces, a decision was that it's better, cheaper, if the Afghans would do it, and we would be in support mode. And so that was one, that's, that we needed to build Afghan institutions, help build Afghan institutions to control the Afghan territory. That uncontrolled territory would attract terrorists. Second was this kind of a vision that the president acquired over time, and especially in his second term, which was that the Middle East, broader Middle East, Islamic parts from Pakistan to Morocco was the kind of dysfunctional region that produced security problems for the world, the way a dysfunctional Europe before World War II and until the end of World War II had been the security problem of the world, leading or producing two world wars and many other wars and conflicts in their own region and beyond. And so the president embraced his vision of transforming the Middle East into a zone of peace, prosperity, and democracy the way Europe had become. And that democratization was a key requirement. And therefore, Iraq and Afghanistan were the two pillars of this new Middle East, the transformed Middle East. And so I think those two forces, beliefs, and particularly with President Bush, I think we're contributors to this broader vision for transformation of Afghanistan as well.
At the time, were you confident that the mission in Afghanistan was achievable? And looking back on what happened over the last 20 years, do you still think that it was achievable?
I think that at one level, of course, it's hard to reject that vision, the second vision. It's sort of very appealing. You know, that a certain appeal that all peoples everywhere are essentially the same. And that there were times that people thought you couldn't, democracy in Germany couldn't go together, or democracy in Japan, or the people argued about India, given its various communities and belief systems. But there is always the question of ends and means and stages. I thought that what would have required to succeed in that mission, which would have it would have been multi-generational, and it would have also required difficult decisions. For example, you know, what do you do about the sanctuaries for opposition in Pakistan, which produced its own challenges, because we, on the one hand, we were very dependent on Pakistan for the things we did in Afghanistan, including on the military front, and we also needed Pakistan's help on Al-Qaeda. But on the other hand, Pakistan also was providing a safe haven for Taliban leaders. And that was obviously impacted what we did or didn't do, what we achieved or didn't achieve. So in retrospect, it was given all the limitations and the requirements. When some people were saying, in order to pacify Afghanistan, for example, there's some colleagues at RAND where I had worked, you would have had to occupy with 450,000 or so troops, and the will to do that was not there. So it was an appealing vision, kind of a daring vision, but it was unrealistic, obviously, given the constraints and the circumstances, both there and here.
We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor, then we'll be right back with more of our discussion with Sal Khalilzad.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
So, Ambassador, let's turn to the negotiations that you led with the Taliban. I want to understand them, and I want my listeners to understand them. And let me start by asking you what your instructions were from President Trump. What were his objectives in beginning these negotiations?
President Trump changed his mind in Afghanistan. Initially, under the influence of General McMaster, embraced a new South Asia strategy. And then by the time the administration reached out to me, he had gone sour on his own strategy that he had enunciated, and had come to a belief that we were not prevailing in Afghanistan, and that Afghanistan was going south, and it was at the same time as we were not prevailing, it was too expensive. that Afghanistan did not rank in terms of importance to the United States in his judgment, that we should be spending perhaps as high as $40 billion a year. So that he wanted to get out of Afghanistan. And that he wanted a safe withdrawal of forces and some commitment, credible commitment on terrorism from the Afghans, and that the mission that I was given was to sit with the Talibs and engage the government to see if an agreement could be achieved where the U.S. could withdraw from Afghanistan its forces relatively soon, but get some commitments on counterterrorism. And at the same time, Secretary Pompeo and myself thought that it would be desirable in achieving or trying to achieve the president's objective of departing Afghanistan to get a political agreement, to try to get a political agreement between the government of Afghanistan that we supported and recognized and the Taliban also, and that a peace agreement, a political agreement would serve our interest, leave a good legacy behind. I have to say that the President Trump and even Secretary Pompeo, like the rest of us, they were skeptical how easy that that would be to get the Afghans to agree to a political agreement. I thought myself that was very important, nevertheless, to try. That although the chances may not be high, but it's important enough that it's worth trying. It would be the right thing to do. It will serve U.S. interests, not only in Afghanistan, but but beyond, to have tried. And maybe we could, with the help from others, with influence on both sides, we could achieve a political agreement. So, and the instructions were along the lines I just described, and I was launched to go and talk to the Talibs and the government.
So given the situation on the ground in Afghanistan, and given that President Trump was publicly signaling that we were going to leave, did you feel yourself negotiating from a position of weakness or not?
Well, I think that it was with the Talibs, it was making it difficult, especially in after the agreement was signed with the Talibs, I'm talking about more in 2020, and the president, because the agreement was a condition-based agreement, his statements earlier that he was willing to leave Afghanistan was helpful in dealing with the Talibs, because and they were very suspicious that the U.S. would ever leave Afghanistan. Many Afghans, as you know, saw that their country was the most important piece of real estate in the world. I mean, that Afghanistan is close to China, close to Russia, next to Pakistan and Iran. Who would want to leave that piece of geopolitical real estate? And so the president, I think his statements at the beginning were helpful in give more credibility to that being in Afghanistan is not an end in itself for us. And I made that point that only we would want to be there if we felt that terrorism could take our place and threaten the security of the United States again. But later, as an agreement, I'm sure you might ask about that, we will talk about it, was a condition-based agreement, but he made it more and more clear as of the summer of 2020 that he wanted to get out regardless of conditions. And that made the job harder, because the Talibs committed to things in the agreement that they were dragging their feet and implementing, and they got away with it because the agreement said that we will go from phase one, which was to come down to 8,600, to the next phase after assessing whether the Talibs had met the conditions of the agreement. And I briefed the Congress on that several times, but we didn't actually in reality do that. He was just announcing that we should go down to this number and or the other, 4,500 from 8,600, and then to leave altogether before his term was over. So that was not helpful in terms of the negotiations. But but his interest was to get the troops out without the troop being threatened and by the Talibs, and that happened.
Yeah, and that's exactly where I was going. Can you walk us through the outcome of the negotiations? What did the United States get? What did the Taliban get? Etc.
Yeah, the agreement, the result of almost a year of negotiations, had four elements. One was the Taliban commitment not to allow any terrorist group, including Al-Qaeda, which was specifically mentioned, and that was one of the hardest things to get out of them, to use the soil of Afghanistan, initially the areas that they controlled, but ultimately, if they became part of a future government, the whole of Afghanistan against the United States and our allies, to plot and plan against the United States and our allies. The second was a timetable for withdrawal of U.S. forces. Third was the beginning of inter-Afghan negotiations for the establishment of a new government. And fourth was a comprehensive and permanent ceasefire. The conditionality of the U.S. withdrawal with regard to terrorism was very tight. The conditionality U.S. withdrawal with regard to inter-Afghan negotiations and agreement and comprehensive ceasefire was not as tight. The four were described as a package, but people were nervous in Washington, including the president, that if we made the conditions tight, then we would get stuck there, as the Afghans might never come to an agreement with each other. But the government of Afghanistan was unhappy about that. They wanted a tight connection between withdrawal and the formation of a new government, and that we wouldn't withdraw, in other words, until there was an agreement. But those were the four key elements of the agreement.
And can you give us, Ambassador, any insight into what was in the so-called secret annexes? Why did there need to be secret annexes?
Yeah. Well, thank you for asking that. That's an important question. The secret annexes, classified annexes, were two. One, we wanted to do it, and that was the sort of dealing with the issues of sequences in terms of bases that we withdrew from. And that was the operational issue, which five bases we were going to leave in the first phase, which they were, and what are the subsequent phases, sequencing, and what it would take. Second annex had to do with terrorism commitments of the Talibs, what they would do with regard to Daesh, and what they would do with regard to other groups, and how we would interact with each other on the issue of terrorism in the operational details of it. So it wasn't anything about the future of Afghanistan or about our military presence there. There's been a lot written and speculated on as to what those annexes dealt with. They really dealt with operational details of those two issues.
Gotcha. So with the signing of the agreement, what did you expect to happen And then when did that picture start to diverge from your expectations? I just wonder if a big part of this is the failure of the talks between the Taliban and the Afghan government.
Yeah. Well, on the U.S. Taliban part of it, the agreement was largely implemented, meaning that the Taliban had agreed that as soon as the agreement was signed, there will be no attacks by the Talibs against U.S. and coalition forces. So for 18 months since, there was not a single fatality, U.S. Or coalition by the from the Talib attacks after the signing. Second was that the Talibs agreed that we could defend the Afghan forces. If they attacked the Afghan forces, since there was no ceasefire yet between the government and the Talibs, and there was no negotiations even, their conflict will continue. There will be some things that won't happen and something that would happen, including that if they attack the government forces, the U.S. coalition could come to the defense of the Afghan forces by attacking the Talibs. And we delivered on that, and the Talibs, although very unhappy that sometimes they wanted the attack to take place where the fight was, we interpreted it more broadly, but nevertheless, they didn't escalate by attacking and killing Americans. And on terrorism, in terms of not allowing plotting and planning, we were satisfied that they did that. There was a question of whether they should break ties and expel those terrorists who were there, like Al-Qaeda. Frankly, the discussions were interesting. I can't go into all the details except that did we want to have them expelled from Afghanistan, where these people would go, or is it better given that we were in Afghanistan if they were there but not allowed to plot and plan so we can keep an eye on them and even hit them if we decide to do so. But when it came to inter-Afghan negotiation, which for Afghanistan was the most important, there were challenges. One was that the Talibs had not wanted to meet with the Afghan government, and in order to do so, they had proposed that all prisoners held by both sides be released. Ultimately, in the agreement, it stated that up to 5,000 Taliban prisoners, the government had some 15,000 plus Talib prisoners, and all the prisoners that the government had with the Talib, meaning 1,000 government prisoners were the Talibs were holding, should be free. Ultimately, that took a while to do, although the agreement said within 10 days negotiations should begin. But ultimately, it did start 5 or 6 months later. And the government was dragging its feet also. The negotiation didn't go as smoothly as we would have liked. Our elections was a factor for the government. The government was hoping that the new administration would perhaps be less anxious to withdraw forces, be more supportive in the negotiation. They thought the Trump administration was not as supportive of the government as it should have been or should be. We tried to accelerate the negotiations because the 14 months of timetable was sort of, we were running out of that. We would have liked to see the agreement before the withdrawal was completed. And if there was an agreed, negotiated government, we wanted to negotiate a security and political relationship with that government. We proposed then a plan of our own to bring the two sides together. But if you ask, I will tell you what that plan included. But nevertheless, the inter-Afghan negotiations did not make progress. As the fighting went on, government was losing ground, even with our support of them by attacking the Talibs and obviously providing support for the Afghan military forces.
Was the Afghan government in any way, Ambassador, reluctant to engage in these negotiations because they weren't at the table for your negotiations? Was there any linkage there or not?
No, our negotiation with the Talibs was also a negotiation with the government, except that they were not at the table. I shuttled with my team, that was an interagency team, between the two sides. And the government was entirely in the picture as to what we were doing. Sometimes there was a statements that they were not in the picture. No, they were in the picture. And the same day that we signed the agreement with the Talibs, we had a joint statement with the government that had all the key elements in it as well. But the government obviously would have preferred, and understandably so, that it negotiate with the Talibs with us supporting it, sitting behind it. But we had tried that for the previous 16, 17 years. And over time, incrementally, the policy objectives or approach change. Initially, we wanted the Talibs to accept the constitution, renounce terror, accept the new government and abandon violence to talk to them. But as the situation militarily became more difficult, our position evolved until under President Obama, we started to talk to the Talibs and they opened their office in Doha. And the Trump administration, after trying this new South Asia strategy, embraced that, and I took over from colleagues who had discussed or negotiated with the Talib before. But the government would have preferred that President Ghani in particular, his preference was for him and the leader of the Taliban to sit together and negotiate an agreement. It was Sadat to Jerusalem was often his metaphor to me. And the Talibs were never prepared to do that. So the choice would have been either we go the route that we decided to do, we negotiate, and then that opens the door to Afghan-Afghan negotiations, or to continue the fight and the fight. We were losing ground each year. For the previous 6 or 7 years, each year, the Talibs right. had gained more ground than the year before. So the military trends were not positive. There was no desire to kind of escalate, send money more forces. So either you kind of had a kind of worsening stalemate and you negotiate, or just keep doing more of the same.
So with regard to the Taliban, you know, they said they were willing to do these negotiations. You know, there are some people who say that they were just telling us what we wanted to hear and they weren't serious about coming to an agreement. What's your view on that?
I think that there were differences inside the Taliban about that. And especially as it became more and more clear that the President Trump wanted to leave, withdraw the forces, that those who thought we can have the whole thing rather than what I put ultimately on the table of a 50-50 power sharing. I gave them essentially both sides of plan because they were not, they were dragging their feet on both sides on kind of procedural issues for a very long time. And yet the timetable of 14 months, we were running out of time. And that besides 50-50, that the leader would be someone that would be mutually acceptable. I think there were differences, but with I think the people like Mullah Baradar, the leader of the delegation, and others thought that the political settlement, although the terms shifted, the balance shifted from being a power sharing to an inclusive government, to a government then to be dominated by the Talibs, with the security ministries, as the ground realities were changing, they adjusted that would be better for them than an outright military takeover because of the questions of acceptance by the international community, sanctions. There were a list of things they wanted, and which would have only happened if there was a negotiated settlement. So I think I would say broadly they wanted a political settlement, but the terms that kept changing, and it became more. They became more demanding as our desire to leave became ever more apparent, and we withdrew. We reduced to a 2,500 without doing an honest to goodness assessment of whether the Talibs had met the conditions by the end of the Trump administration. That was one driving factor that empowered or emboldened Talibs to make more demands than they did when the negotiation started. And second was the change also on the ground, that the Afghan forces were not performing as well as they, some of them at least, had anticipated they would do. Those two factors, I think, made them more demanding. But they, nevertheless, even 2 weeks before the takeover of Kabul, we made an agreement that they announced, in which is that they would not enter Kabul, and that the delegation will come, including former President Karzai and Dr. Abdullah and others, that by then President Ghani had empowered them that he would accept whatever they negotiated, and that there will be a ceremony for transfer of power to a Talib-dominated but inclusive government, that up to 13 Republican officials will be members of the cabinet, was kind of the goal that was being discussed.
And did you get, particularly in those early months of the Taliban interacting with the Afghan government, did you get the support that you needed from Washington, the support you needed from the White House and the State Department? You know, as somebody looking at this from the outside, it didn't seem like there was a lot of engagement. So I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that. Could you have used more help?
I think that I could have used more help, definitely, always, then especially. And and we were divided, you can imagine, from your own vast experience, on what would be the right tactic to do. One, of course, I thought approaching a condition-based approach would be, if we wanted a negotiated settlement, would be helpful. And especially with President Biden, we tried hard to describe the various options that he faced as a new president. And he, although differed from President Trump in many ways, but on linking American troop presence to an agreement among Afghans, he was very similar to his predecessor. He did not want to make a withdrawal conditional, particularly if it meant we might have to go back to fight. In other words, the Talib commitment not to attack us would expire, and we would have to defend ourselves. That was the supposition. I thought that if we didn't want to do a condition base, then the thing to do was to press President Ghani to be more realistic in terms of a settlement. Because President Ghani had many friends in Washington. He was well known here. And people were pressing me not to press him too hard at the same time as we were thinking we were going to get out. Based on a calendar, and I think that was very much wrong-headed in my judgment, with all due respect, because President Ghani, and until it was relatively late, was making demands as if he had won the war rather than he was losing the war, and Washington's approach to him that we shouldn't press him as hard as we needed to do for him to make a deal that was realistic, meaning that he wouldn't lead the peace government, that somebody that both sides would accept would have to lead it. And he insisted until the very end that he would lead the post-agreement government until there is an election, and then the his successor will be decided in an election. And that was not the given the realities on the ground and the speed with which they were moving. It was unrealistic, and we didn't press him hard enough, in my view, in a timely manner on this issue to be helpful to him and to his country and its future.
We're going to take another quick break. We'll be right back with more Intelligence Matters. Stay with us.
We all have busy lives these days, and we don't want to waste a day recovering after a night out. That's why ZBiotics is the answer we've all been looking for. Their probiotic was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. This is a proactive solution that wards off feeling miserable the next day instead of a reactive approach like drinking electrolytes or eating greasy food. Enhance your mornings with ZBiotics. Go to ZBiotics.com/CBS to get 15% off your first order when you use code CBS at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. No questions asked. Remember to head to ZBiotics.com/CBS and use the code CBS at checkout for 15% off. Thank you, ZBiotics, for sponsoring this episode and our good times.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
So, Ambassador, I want to switch to a couple of questions about our last months in Afghanistan. And I guess I want to start by asking you if you agreed with President Biden's decision to follow through on President Trump's commitment to withdraw all U.S. forces.
Well, I preferred, and Tony Blinken and others, we would have preferred that the president follow a condition-based approach to have a political settlement before full withdrawal. But then the president decided that if the Talibs were going to go back to war, if that was a judgment, if we didn't withdraw in a timely manner, that he, and his own pessimism, longstanding about Afghanistan and the willingness of Afghan leaders to come together, then we did all that we could, myself included, to implement the president's decision and to gain more time. The president decided that since the review process has taken a long time, that we needed 4 more months for withdrawal to be completed, in effect, to make the timetable 18 months plus rather than 14 months, which it was. And that was the single most important focus of my effort to make sure that the Talibs do not attack us after the 14-month date, and then to push. Nevertheless, with the president's decision in mind, to see what if we could accelerate a political settlement, and we succeeded with regard to the Talibs not attacking us. We did not succeed in terms of getting a political settlement between the Talibs and the government, and even what was agreed to on the 15th of August by the government and the Talibs. Finally, we got an agreement on August 15 between the two sides. But then with President Ghani's departure, a surprise to everyone on August 15, and the disintegration of whatever forces that remained, the Talibs asked us whether we would take responsibility for Kabul's security or they would go in, and ultimately they went in, and so there was no political agreement.
At what point, Ambassador, did it become clear to you that the Afghan government would collapse?
Well, I actually was rather late. I thought, frankly, that the government it would take some time for it to collapse. I was surprised myself by the decision of the Afghan forces with the speed to which they turned over areas to the Taliban without a fight. And I was very surprised also by the Barangani's decision 3 hours before his departure. He agreed with me and with his own channels with the Talibs on this 2 weeks of ceasefire, essentially, in Kabul and these negotiations. So I was surprised that he departed without letting very many people around him know.
Why do you think he fled?
I really don't know for sure. I think he was perhaps persuaded that the Taliban might not honor the agreement, that he might get caught in Kabul, and terrible things could happen to him and his perhaps. President Najib of the post-Soviet government was hanged by the forces similar to the Talibs. So whether that was what persuaded him, but he had told Secretary of State Tony Blinken the night before that he was not going to leave, that he was going to stay in Afghanistan, and he had announced many times that he wasn't going to leave, do some of what some Afghan leaders in the past had done to leave the country. So we were surprised by that. If his personal security was at risk, he could have asked for help. I'm sure we would have considered it. Remember, you might remember that we sent people to protect President Karzai for many months at the beginning when he felt there was a security problem. So, but he didn't, and we were very much surprised by what happened.
And then what's your view of the U.S. government's execution of our departure? Did it need to be as messy as it was?
Well, terrible. Of course, it was a debacle, embarrassing. No one was happy about it. I'm sure President Biden included. Logistically, we did amazing things, obviously, but something happened, a combination that was quite powerful and negative, which is that there was an impression created that the Talibs coming into the city, although many leaders asked for the Talibs to come in once the forces disintegrated in Kabul, but the public impression was that there would be street-to-street fighting, and many people would get killed. There would be widespread destruction. That was the Afghan experience of the last fight after the Soviet departure, which destroyed Kabul. We departed ourselves. We closed the embassy and moved to the airport. Which was not the plan. The plan had been that we will keep the embassy, and I had talked to the Talibs about numbers of forces we will have to protect the embassy and the airport. But nevertheless, given the scenario of the Ghani departure, then the second thing that combined with the first, this fear, the first, second was opportunity, which is anyone who can make it to the airport would be taken to the U.S. or Europe, whether you have documents or not, created this this disastrous situation, the scenario, as I said before, was that we would stay in at the embassy and we'll keep the airport, and that the Turks would either run it, and then we thought we would run it in combination with others, and we'll maintain some forces which we had informed the Talibs, and that's why the sequencing of which the withdrawal was background before Kabul airport, before full withdrawal, because we didn't plan to withdraw or abandon Kabul airport or the embassy. So, but the scenario changed, and yes, lots of questions about the execution there, yes.
So, Ambassador, the future, you know, where to now in Afghanistan? And maybe the place to start is with politics. Mullah Baradar, who you dealt with in the negotiations, is not in the top job. He seems to have been sidelined a bit. The Haqqani family is playing a big role. And since the Taliban took power, we've seen them carry out public executions, torture, violence against women. They've forbidden women from attending secondary schools, playing sports, etc. Are the hardliners in charge here? How would you describe the governing regime at the moment?
First, I think the hardliners are more powerful, but I think your description is not that I don't agree with exactly that this is not the Taliban of the 1990s. I believe that with regard to women, they are saying they will, all women will go to high school. They announced yesterday that March 21st, Afghan New Year, all high schools for girls would be open. In 9 provinces, already girls go to high school. And in private universities, men and women go to school, university. Public universities have not been opened yet. The level of violence in terms of killings is obviously unacceptable. It's far less than feared given the magnitude of the change that has happened. But nevertheless, media is, I watch Afghan media very closely, very active, very critical of the Talibs. Men and women, both presenters in the evening news. There are problems, obviously. The women in many ministries, there have been limitations on. I think the way the change happened undermined the Doha group because the change didn't come through negotiations. And Haqqanis are in power, particularly in Kabul. And there are tensions inside with also some religious figures around Ayatollah playing an important role. There is therefore 3 sort of groupings. I think that the story of Afghanistan is not finished, of course, although our role has changed obviously dramatically. But Talibs want things from the international community, normalcy, unfreezing of the money of Afghanistan, getting off lists, economic assistance. And we want things from the Talibs on terrorism, given the changed situation, as well as on rights of Afghans. And I believe that we have unfinished business in the sense that the Doha Agreement in its entirety hasn't been implemented. I've been an advocate of sitting together with the Talibs, reaching another agreement in writing that details of the details what it is that we will do in exchange for what. And that would also positively affect, in my view, the balance of power inside with the Taliban. I think politics here is hindering the steps that I think our national interest demands, which is to engage and make progress on the terrorism account in the new environment and on kind of on our values with regard to women, in exchange for which there are things that the Talib want that we would do, but it has to be negotiated in details and in writing so that all the factions of the Talibs understand what the agreement is. I think turning our back on Afghanistan, the political cost and the security cost would be higher down the road if Afghanistan collapses and terrorism expands. I think you pay now or you pay later. There may be some costs, political costs for engagement and negotiating seriously, but the cost will be much higher, both politically and otherwise. If we don't, then the situation gets a lot worse.
with the Haqqanis in charge in Kabul, with the leader of the Haqqanis as the interior minister, I'm wondering if you're concerned about the Taliban commitment with regard to Al-Qaeda.
I am concerned about that. Haqqanis want badly to get off the list. They are a terrorist group. They want to know, they say, how they can get off of that list. And there are people who are offering themselves as intermediaries to deal with this situation. There should be a path for people to earn their way back, but that can't be just based on promises. There will have to be performance for a substantial period of time before steps are taken that they are asking for. I think there is room for diplomacy. We have unfinished business, the business of the nation there. But yes, I think Haqqanis are a particular group of concern because of Al-Qaeda.
Ambassador, I want to just end here with a couple of final questions. The first is, there's been a lot of blame thrown your way. Your critics have said that you've become the face of one of the largest U.S. diplomatic failures in history. And the first question I wanted to ask you is, what do you believe are the biggest misconceptions about the end of our involvement in Afghanistan and your role in it?
Well, the obvious one is that people think I've decided everything as if I was the commander-in-chief and the president. I wasn't. I was a member of a team, a significant player, but that's one. And two, people are unrealistic about what our options were. The situation in Afghanistan was not a good one, and we were losing ground, as I said before. The president wanted to get out, and in those circumstances, I think there were some achievements getting out safely of the forces, some commitments on terrorism. But on the Afghan-Afghan negotiations, the pessimists turned out to be right. I personally, because of my own background, give it all that I could to bring the Afghans to the negotiating table. They did, but to agree and they didn't. And I'm unhappy about that. But I think for Afghanistan to work, that's the unfinished part, and diplomacy must continue. And we should use our leverage, and it's considerable. And the Talibs want to talk to us. The other Afghans want to talk to us. To help them achieve that lasting political agreement that they did not during the timetable that we agreed to the Talibs, the 14 months. I am not happy that did not happen, but it was not for lack of trying.
And I wanted to ask you the misconception question, but I also want to ask you the other obvious question, which is, with 2020 hindsight now, are there things that you wish you would have done differently?
Well, I always think about that. I mean, I think about it every day when I do something. People say maybe we should have gotten the UN more involved. We tried that. Maybe we could have done more I could have made a better case to convince the leaders of the United States to press President Ghani more. For example, I feel that we did not do well by him, by perhaps not pressing him hard enough, although the public perception is we pressed him too hard. Yes, I think about it all the time, and I thought about it during that period as well, what ifs. But, I did what I could at the time when I confronted the issue, and I tried to convince the leaders of the U.S. sometimes to do things differently, like condition-based, which was an essential thing. But I always felt that I should try and try harder. I could have left after the agreement with the Talibs, but I could have threatened to leave several times or actually left to get the president to change his mind. I didn't do that. I thought that being there, perhaps I was going to be more helpful, that the soldiers don't get the option of resigning. Perhaps they do, but they don't. And I felt the same way, that I had to do my very best to serve the interests of the United States and the president that I worked for.
Mr. Ambassador, thank you so much for joining us. We really look forward to your next book.
Well, thank you. It's great to be with you. And thank you for the conversation and the very informed questions that you asked.
That was Zalmay Khalilzad. I'm Michael Morrell. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
Intelligence Matters is sponsored by Palantir Technologies, foundational software of tomorrow, delivered today. The show is produced by Olivia Gassis, Jamie Benson, Paulina Smolinski, and Ashley Armstrong. For more from this week's show, visit cbsnews.com. Intelligence Matters is a production of CBS News.
Catch every episode of 60 Minutes, America's most watched news magazine show, as a podcast. Hear in-depth investigations across politics, news, and entertainment on your schedule. Listen to 60 Minutes ad-free on Wondery Plus.